Welcome back to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll have the chance to talk with the author of Fed Power, How Finance Wins. The authors are Lawrence Jacobs and Desmond King. The book is published by Oxford University Press. I have the pleasure to talk with Lawrence Jacobs today. Larry, how are you doing?
I'm doing real good. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. Pleasure to have you on again. You had come on previously with a different co-author. Before we get started, maybe you can just introduce yourself again and also your co-author in this project.
Sure. I'm a frequent researcher on a lot of different topics in American politics, particularly public opinion and elections, political representation and democracy, and health policy. This book, which is on the Federal Reserve, is a new area for me and one that I really felt obligated almost to take on about 5 or 6 years ago. My co-author, Des King, who's at Oxford University, shares my passion about understanding the American political system, both in terms of what's going on in Washington, but also the relationships between Washington and the various political and economic interests that are trying to constrain and drive what our government does.
Yeah, and you know, and framing it in that way, it does raise sort of this real question that I wanted to ask you at the start, but which is, you know, despite its significance, political scientists have tended not to spend very much time focusing on the Federal Reserve. Why do you think this is the case? Why is this gap in the literature there?
First off, you're absolutely right. It's extraordinary. When Des King and I started thinking about the very beginning of this project, we kept looking for the definitive work that would really take on the Fed and think about the institutions of the Federal Reserve, both in Washington and the regional structure, but also the interests of finance. And nothing has really been written in terms of a comprehensive book in almost 3 decades, which is astounding given the importance of the Fed. And I should say that is within political science. There's quite a bit of writing by economists and those who specialize in the Fed, but they have a, you know, I think from the perspective of at least sociology and political science, the economic view of the Fed is quite different, and the idea of political economy and the role of organized interest and institutions is largely ignored in the way a lot of us kind of understand it. So we took this on, frankly, because we were looking for explanations for what was happening during the financial crisis. And we wanted to be able to cite and, frankly, invite some of these important authors who were writing about the Fed to some conferences we were holding in Oxford. We couldn't find any. There were people who, again, who had written about it decades ago, but that really wasn't up to the task of the financial crisis in 2008 and 9. And so we felt almost drawn into this. It is a difficult topic. I do a lot on health policy, and that's certainly a complex topic. But I would say the complexity of capital markets and central banking is still even another kind of rung up in terms of the technical matter. And that may deter some political scientists who may not want to put in the time to really learn about finance. But it's a big loss. What I've learned about finance has really reshaped the way I think about American politics.
Now, you refer in the book to, and I'll quote, the exceptionalism of Fed power and authority. I wonder if you could give us the short history, not the long, very complicated history, but just the short history of the Fed as it relates to this unusual institutional structure and its exceptional nature.
So let me first start by saying that if you look back on the study of American politics for the last half century, the common theme has been the ways in which the American government and state is highly fragmented. You can think of someone like Ted Lowy or, those who study Congress or the presidency. And the theme is always about how power is dispersed, about the conflict and dysfunction of our government institutions. They battle each other across these competing lines of authority. So that's the backdrop. The Fed is not like that. It's really an exception because we've seen this historic trajectory since it was established in 1913 of starting out as basically a regional collection of Federal Reserve banks. And that is revealed during the Great Depression not to have been terribly effective. Monetary policy or in serving as a last resort. And then particularly since the 1950s, the enormous expansion of the technical capacity of the Fed to do a variety of different kinds of financial and economic analyses, but also, and perhaps especially, its growing autonomy and independence, first from the U.S. Treasury and then from the government overall. So we are now looking at a institution like no other in the domestic arena. In terms of the overall government, I would say the Fed is akin to the National Security Agency in terms of its ability to go it alone and to have the capacity to do that.
Now, one might ask, what's the harm in this technocratic arrangement? Which aspects of the Great Recession can we pin to the Fed and its peculiar design?
That's a good question, and in fairness, there's certainly a need for a central bank. This is not a book that takes a page from Ron Paul and talks about ending the Fed. Just the opposite. Given the volatility of financial markets and the need for monetary policy, we strongly believe and make the case that we need a central bank. The problem is the type of central bank we have in America, which is separate from, independent of our democratic process. And when you look at other capitalist countries with central banks, the Fed stands out for the independence and for its attention to finance. So look at the crisis and you see this mix. On the one hand, the Federal Reserve certainly played a critical, indispensable role in heading off a Great Depression. We had a classic run on our financial institutions and our credit markets had frozen. If the Federal Reserve had not stepped in to loosen up credit markets, we would have been back into a kind of 1930s style financial crisis. Now, having said that, though, there are several reasons for not being simply satisfied with that. Though I would add that most of the Fed watchers use that story I've just told as justification on its own for the enormous power and independence of the Fed. First, the Federal Reserve's power and its influence, as great as it was, did not prevent it from making a catastrophic error. And you may remember, as you kind of think back over the history since 2009 and 10, there was this disturbing pattern where we would get to the beginning of, let's say, 2011 or 12 or 13 or 14, and the Fed would come out or the IMF would come out with encouraging reports about the economic recovery that was now going to happen. It really was going to happen this year, and it would fizzle. We now know from some very important research that's been done that one of the reasons that the economic recovery was so stalled was the enormous household debt that saddled consumers. And that was a mistake on the part of the Fed. They should have been addressing that household debt, and ignoring it really put a drag on our ability to get the economy going and get jobs being created and especially getting income rising again. That was a mistake. Now, that's tied to the second issue, which is the Fed's favoritism. When the Fed was engaged in creating programs to restore the credit markets, it, and really this is quite different from what we see in other countries, was focused almost solely on the large financial institutions. They did virtually nothing for the 13 million American households that were in foreclosure proceedings between 2008 and 2013. Those families that saw, you know, over $2 trillion in equity wiped out, and particularly African-American families that were really decimated by the Great Recession, there was no help from the Fed. And so you've got this contrast between enormous credit being delivered to big finance and little being done for households and businesses. Now, one of the responses we got from central bankers when we first started presenting this is, well, the Fed couldn't do anything else. There were no alternatives. So we spent some time going around and looking at what other central banks were doing, and that's just not the case. If you take a look at the staid conservative Bank of England, they did something that was inconceivable in the United States. They served as a last resort, as the Federal Reserve did, in extending credit to banks and non-banks. But in exchange for providing that credit, it also attached conditions. Conditions that required those banks and non-banks to offer assistance to homeowners faced with foreclosure and businesses faced with bankruptcy or severe economic problems. And so you can see a very different orientation in other countries. Now, notice those measures, that helps to address this household debt issue. And the Fed just wasn't focused on it, and frankly, it didn't need to.
And for what reason is it not focused on that? Because these seem like quite obvious dimensions of the problem that other countries are dealing with, and yet the design and the personnel working for the Fed are averse to these solutions. Why is that? What's the explanation that you come to?
Well, there are three different types of explanations, and we look at them. One is that the Fed is captured by big finance. And this would mean you might expect, you know, the financial lobbies to have literally moved into the Fed. And, you know, there's certainly some cases where you could point to, and they've been covered in the media. But it's really hard to find that kind of explicit arm twisting. And the Fed, because it's so secretive, we don't really have access to that much information. So we found it difficult to really sustain this capture argument, though we don't dismiss it. Another possibility is that there's this revolving door, that the folks who work in Wall Street kind of shift positions over to the Fed, and the people in the Fed kind of move into big finance. And there's certainly some cases of that. You'll notice that Ben Bernanke cashed in his job as chair of the Fed for a very nice, actually several positions in finance that are paying him quite handsomely. But again, it's hard to sustain that as a general explanation. What struck us is that it wasn't simply the individuals who were changing positions or the kind of fingerprints of pressure groups, but the very basic organizational incentives of the Federal Reserve. And here's what I mean. The bread and butter for the Federal Reserve is the money it makes by selling and buying treasuries on the stock market and in financial markets. It raises an enormous amount of money. The Federal Reserve, unlike other government institutions, does not go to Congress for appropriations. This is a very important point. If you think about the government shutdowns in Washington and state governments that have, you know, kind of shuttered state parks, federal parks, and threatened other important government services, the Fed never has to face that because it raises its own money through financial markets by its very operations. So the interests of the Fed are directly tied to its ability to sustain and to encourage the prospering of finance. You don't need to have a pressure group, and you don't need to have a kind of changing of the guard in terms of revolving doors. The Fed's rationality, its basic interests, are to keep finance secure and profitable.
Now, would you talk a little bit about the movement to reform the Fed? For so long, this was associated with Ron Paul, but you show that the attention paid to the weaknesses of the Fed is much wider than just that. So how formalized is the pressure to change some of these institutional rules of the Fed?
So we went back and we looked at other periods where the Fed was kind of in the news, and there have been some books and articles, and you know, you can go back, for instance, to the early 1980s when there was a horrific recession. And the Fed was blamed in part for that because it shot up interest rates in an effort to squelch inflation. And when you look at the debates in Congress and around the country, it was mostly focused on a very particular set of policies, interest rates, the emphasis on cutting off inflation, and whether that was too great a focus. There was very little about the organizational and the prerogatives of the Fed. That's changed today. And you certainly have the libertarian voices. Rand Paul, who's in the Senate, is an example of that. But you also have a group of progressives, Elizabeth Warren and others, who are pressing for a significant reorganization of the Federal Reserve. Our perspective is that this is a symptom of the fact that the Fed has overreached and it's engaged in policies that are simply undemocratic and unfair to working Americans and to businesses on Main Street.
And what would a change actually look like? Is this a legislative process, or is this something that would come through an executive order? What would change of the Fed actually entail?
Well, in our view, we need a new game plan. Because America is now on a path where we're having financial crises about every decade or so. And Dodd-Frank was a response to this overreach by the Fed that I've been describing. And what Dodd-Frank, which is the most significant reform since the Great Depression and was passed in 2010, it did some great good, including setting up the Consumer Protection Bureau, that everybody is now seeing the results in terms of the conduct of credit card companies and others. But that approach was basically to attempt to handcuff the Fed. And in some respects, it makes America less able to fend off the next financial crisis. What we need, this is the argument that Des King and I make at Fed Power, is a new game plan. The game plan would have three parts. One, the Federal Reserve has enormous responsibilities in the area of regulation. And this, in a way, pulls the Fed in several different directions. It's being asked both to work in financial markets, but it's also being asked to be a cop on the financial market beat. And it's proven difficult for the Fed to do both. We think that the Fed's responsibilities ought to be pared back in terms of regulation. Secondly, there's a principle in public administration that public authority ought to follow public money. In this case, the use of public authority to extend loans and guarantees. And there ought to be a significant change from what is now, in some significant ways, private control of the Fed. The Federal Reserve is 12 regional banks, as well as a national office in Washington, which has a board of governors. Those 12 regional banks, two-thirds of the membership on the boards of those 12 regional banks are held by private financial interests. So you've got kind of private banks and equity firms and others who are running the show in those regional banks. That seems to be a mistake to us. We also agree with some of the bipartisan legislation introduced that the president of the New York Fed, which is the most important, ought to be a position that the president nominates and subject to Senate confirmation. Third, and perhaps most important, is that we need to move away from this highly fragmented approach to the administration of finance. Let me give you an example. One of the biggest steps that Dodd-Frank took was to create a stability board to govern systematically important financial institutions. Well, that stability board is controlled by 10 different agencies. I mean, this is like imagining 10 cooks in the kitchen. It's going to be very difficult for that to be very effective. And there is decades of research on administration that backs up that concern. What we've seen in other countries, such as Canada, that's created a coordinated administrative structure and given both authority and to a superintendent who is responsible to the legislative branch, is that it's possible to actually police in a responsible and effective way finance. 2008 and 9, America almost went back to the Great Depression. Canada never experienced a 2008 and 9 crisis. Canada never had a direct taxpayer bill out like TARP. How did it do it? It had a different approach to financial administration, and we need to take a look at that and see if there are elements that we can draw on.
Yeah, the book again, Fed Power, How Finance Wins, published by Oxford University Press this year. The authors Lawrence Jacobs and Desmond King. Larry, thank you so much for your time today.
Good to be with you.